Are you ready to level up? Join us as we talk to people in various fields who share their journeys with us.
Hear about the obstacles they faced and how they've overcome and what they're learning. Hey, I'm your host, Cheryl Nemhard.
And I'm your other host, Danielle Zapchenk, and this is the Together We Rise podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Together We Rise podcast, a podcast brought to you by Women Speaker Collective, a tribe of fierce women that are changing the landscape of the Big C Church and making a huge impact in their community. And speaking of huge impact, well, I want you guys to strap on. As they say, when you're about to go on a crazy ride, keep your hands inside the vehicle at all times. Because you are in for a joyride, and I gave a little hint. Danielle, tell us who we have today.
Yes. Joy Flores has been serving marginalized communities for the past 21 years and just moved to Nashville after serving on Skid Row for 4 years at Union Rescue Mission. She is still committed to the work now as Vice President of Ministries at Nashville Rescue Mission. She's been married for 17 years and have 4 kids that range from 10 to 15. And this woman is a force to be reckoned with and truly exemplifies her name. Please welcome Joy Flores.
Ow!
Wow. Thanks, guys.
Yes. Gosh, Joy, thank you so much for being with us. One thing that, you know, drew us to you is you were recently at our Long Beach boot camp, and we were kind of just going around and sharing a movie title, I believe, of your life. So could you share with everyone, because this is really going to set the stage, what was your movie title?
You know, it took me about 5 seconds to think of what that could might, you know, what that might be. And I said, my movie title is Holy Rebellion, with the tagline, standing at the gates of hell and redirecting traffic.
Which shook me to the core. I just want to say, it was the moment that I was like, not only have I A, fallen in love with her, B, I'm obsessed, C, how do I stalk her now? D, you're not going anywhere. E, what is the big thing God's called us to do together? Because I'm going to pray it in until it happens. It was so many things happened there. Wow. That is literally who you are. You're leading a whole new rebellion.
That's right.
Yeah.
One at a time.
Yeah. Joy, how did this like holy rebellion, this heartbeat of championing the marginalized community, how did that begin for you?
You know, I've always had a heart for at-risk youth, the underdog, if you will, by every accord. But for me, it became personal when I'm the youngest of three. I have an older brother and sister. And when my brother was 16, he was dual diagnosed bipolar schizophrenic, self-medicating tendencies, in and out of every halfway house, treatment center you could possibly imagine. My parents literally tried everything to save him. And when he was 30, you know, he had seasons of success, mind you. He got married, had a kid, but that also ended. He has a grown daughter, my niece. But when he was 30, he actually died on the street about a mile away from Skid Row. So for me, it became very personal, and I had a lot of questions, right? Where was the church? As an outreach pastor, for a lot of my life, I always reevaluated how we do outreach and how we see people, how we restore dignity, and what are the things that last? A hot dog only lasts one meal, right? So how can we offer something that's tangible and eternal on top of salvation? Not just, you know, of course, but on top of that.
Wow. Joy, you know, your entire life in so many ways, physically, emotionally, spiritually connected to those who are in the margins, on the fringes. You've dedicated your life to serving them, but also restoring dignity. You speak a lot about that and the importance of that. I want to ask you, we're going to go like to level, you know, Mach 9 right away, but I know you're good for it. She's a deep soul. Tell us, how have you seen faith spaces, faith organizations, church, the Big C Church, what are we getting wrong? I know that we have gotten it wrong. We have dropped the ball, have caused woundedness, have disappointed, like that big question, where was the church? Help us see through a new lens. What are we seeing wrong here?
Well, two things definitely come to mind with that question. And I think the deeper meaning for me is about 4 years ago, I started reading the Bible through the Middle Eastern lens. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Jesus in his first century Jewish cultural context, everything changes. And I was introduced to these two words that are fond to my heart already, justice and righteousness. But in the Hebrew, mishpat and tzedakah, when they're paired together, there's 30-something pairings of these two words. And when they're together, they mean a generous lifting from shame to honor. And when we were talking about restoring restorative justice, a justice that restores and restores dignity, it is when the honorable come down to the shameful and together they rise. And that righteousness becomes a generosity. So if we look at our outreach efforts and how we are serving those that are on the margins, we know the prophetic voice is on the margins. So where are we hearing that prophetic voice, if we are at all, if we have no proximity to that? But I think when I ask those questions, where was the church? It's because there are 100 million churches that come, especially to Skid Row, and serve. They serve peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. They serve pizzas. They give out waters. Their heart has been moved with compassion, and they want to do something. So they're not doing anything wrong. They're not sinning by any means. They're trying to offer what they have in their hands. But the problem is that that is only half of the problem. Like a mission, like where I am now, National Rescue Mission, we have plenty of food. We also have long-term services, recovery programs, things that are sustainable and scalable and will actually transform their lives. But if we only give the compassion part of that equation, we're not actually doing anything. Because that hot dog, again, you know, it might be a holy hot dog, but it's not leading with relationship. And so my biggest thing, and, you know, that's kind of the mountain that I will die on, is when we look at our churches and how we are engaged in outreach and how we're loving people and how we're reaching people, it has to lead with relationship and build trust. I used to tell my volunteers, get out of the line, get out of the serving line, go sit with the people, listen to their stories, because one day they will be ready for help and you'll be there through that trust that you've built with them, and you can and bring them to services that will change their lives.
Yeah. Joy, I think for this type of role that you are in, and when we are choosing to serve, when we are doing outreach, there is this tension of, you know, there's the frustration and there's such highs and lows. And so for yourself, like, how do you keep the focus on Jesus when this work can be so challenging, but also rewarding at the same time? And you're just navigating both.
Well, especially working at a place that takes no government funds, I sit in some of these meetings of all these other agencies and they're just fighting. You know, they're just arguing about their way is the right way, or we're not doing it right, or whatever it may be, right? But we focus so much on the things that we're doing wrong, and we're not coming together to try to solve the problem collectively. And I pray that we can take some ground in that area and really come together with a strategic plan that works, that offers hope for eternity. But it is really hard to keep going. But again, my focus is never on, it's not on the empire. Mm-hmm. It's on the individual person and the kingdom. And it's one at a time. We can't, when we talk about homelessness, we can't buy our way out of this. We can't build our way out of this. It's one person at a time. There's no one way to homelessness. There's no one way out. So we have to be able to be recklessly brave and come out of ourselves and just look someone in the eye and search for that Imago Dei inside of them.
Oh my goodness. I can't with you, Joy. And you know, it's so funny because as we get into this holiday season, as we're moving into, a time where people are naturally leaning towards thinking of others or serving or being charitable, as much as that gives me warm and fuzzies, this it's also problematic that it's seasonal. And before we get into sort of the meat and potatoes, just like as we think about, you know, Christmas time and even, you know, Advent, and like, how should we be seeing that differently? As opposed to just a time where we think about the less than, or, you know, and I don't even love that phrase, but do you understand what I mean when I say that?
Yes, I do. 100%. And we say the least of these a lot. We say the least of these even in front of the least of these, which doesn't feel dignity restoring at all. But it happens every year. Everybody wants to volunteer. We do a big toy drive. They want to donate toys. They want to come. They want to drop off their, you know, whatever celebrity it is, they want to donate their thing and take. Fine. That's all fine. But again, we are here 365 days a year trying to build a relationship with people, and we desperately need volunteers in March.
That part.
So I think it's just reevaluating the narrative and advocating for our guests, especially those who have come into a program, into a space where they're really looking at their pain. They are being brave and vulnerable and having really hard conversations with their life coaches and therapists. And we can support that journey instead of just, again, making ourselves feel good with a photo op at the soup kitchen on Christmas. I mean, I get asked all the time, especially with so many kids, how do we, you know, our kids are spoiled brats. I want to show them what real life is, or I want to, you know, expose them to these experiences. Yes, 100%. But these conversations also need to be happening around the dinner table.
Talk about it. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I get fired up when we talk about the table. And even thinking about Thanksgiving and thankfulness and what the table represents. And it takes me again back to table fellowship in the first century of Jesus. You know, so let's talk. This is going to be a 30-second detour.
Go for it.
But this gets me so fired up.
Go for it.
So when we look at Luke 7, and, you know, Simon's having dinner at his house. He's a Pharisee. He invites all his Pharisee friends to come and sit at the table. Well, we always think of, like, it's kind of like you see the picture of the Last Supper when they're all like sitting on one side of the table. Well, no, they didn't have tables and chairs. They laid on the floor. Okay, come on. But also one thing that they did was all the dignitaries, let's say, sat around the table, reclined around the table, and Jesus was one of them. He was a young rabbi. They're kind of vetting him, asking these hard questions, seeing where his teaching is and what he stands for. But the part that we don't read that's kind of lost in the cultural context is that at these parties, at these dinners, the Pharisees are sitting, reclining at the table, but they're part of their culture is they want to show that they care for the least of these. So they invite the marginalized. They invite the lepers. They invite the women. But when they come into the room, they are placed around and against the wall. And when the meal is over, they can eat the scraps. So what Jesus does is he's subversive in everything he does. He flips the table because he says, at my table, everybody has a seat at my table. You don't have to stand against the wall anymore.
Come on, Joy.
What? I can't.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Wow. You don't have to sit against the wall. Jeez.
Like, this is what they're called. I mean, and Jesus... You know, Jesus was a plebeian. He was a working class. You know, his dad was a carpenter. He wasn't a king's son and all the things. And he still just cleared the deck. This is not the way it's supposed to be. Yeah. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And that's why it's also so beautiful in Luke 7 with Simon specifically and Mary Magdalene, who is Mary Magdalene, who is the woman who anoints him. The double anointing. She anoints him high with oil and low with her tears. Is that there's these five rituals of hospitality that Simon was supposed to do to welcome Jesus into his home, and he didn't do any of them. And so what Jesus does is he, again, when we go back to shame and honor, he's rearranging the room. He's putting Simon in the shameful place that he is operating in by not honoring Jesus. And he's raising up Mary to that honorable place mm-hmm. that she deserves, even though she came in against the wall. She leaves and he forgives her sins.
Wow. Joy, I love the imagery of the table. I mean, that's we lost Cheryl. Oh, no. While she's recovering, there is this there when we are at the table, we have proximity to one another.
That's right.
That's what you were talking about earlier. That's where we build empathy. And as we challenge ourselves to be recklessly brave, that is going to be uncomfortable. Jesus didn't call us to a comfortable life.
That's right.
So I would just ask you, like, what are some of those things that maybe we just need to step out of the box, and try? Because if we don't try, we're choosing just to be comfortable. And what would those be for you?
I'm actually almost done on my first day here at National Rescue Mission. Our CEO handed me a book by Mark Batterson, In a Pit with a Lion on a Snowy Day. I'm like, what kind of title is this? But it talks about the dude who became the head of Israel's army and his qualifications. It's like two verses in 2 Samuel, I think, where he talks about these are his qualifications. On a snowy day, he killed a lion in a pit. And it talks about opportunity. And it talks a lot about risk. And it talks a lot about rejection. And it really, when you said that, it really resonated with me about being uncomfortable. You have to, in order to overcome rejection, you have to experience rejection. Yeah. And so, obviously be safe, right? Like, don't be a Daryl. Don't go up in an encampment of homeless people in the middle of the night. Like, no, be smart. But also take a risk. Mm-hmm. And that might be looking someone in the eyes or sitting with them and being whole enough in yourself so that you can be a safe space for them to share their pain.
Oh, my goodness. Joy, I'm so thankful for you. We're so thankful for your voice here at Women Speaker Collective. Obviously, for those that are listening, you can see why we just love Joy. She is deeply passionate. And I believe carries the heart of God concerning the poor and those that experience homelessness and those that are addicted and have brokenness as their life story currently, because God is still writing that beautiful story. We talk about getting out of seasonal giving and seasonal serving and really making this more of a rhythm and a natural outflow of our faith. I think people compartmentalize it. It's like we worship, we learn, we sing, we grow, but then the serving, the actual physical walking out, it becomes a challenge and it's all one thing. It's all one thing. It's holistic. And so one of the things we've decided to do here at Women Speaker Collective is to really, as we move into the Advent season and Christmas season, is to really flip Advent on its ear. And to do something completely different and to challenge and invite us all into a reimagining of what Advent can be and how we can prepare our hearts going into the new year to be filled with a heart of service, compassion, love, non-judgment, inclusion, all the things. And so we're calling it an audacious Advent, and I'm going to read the definition of audacious so Joy can run around the room.
Come on.
An audacious Advent. Audacious meaning extremely bold or daring. Mm-hmm. Love this. Recklessly brave. That's her favorite.
There it is.
Extremely original without restriction to prior ideas. In other words, an unlearning of what was. And then highly inventive, or in other words, outside of the box. And so we want to reimagine Advent and look at Advent through the lens of restorative justice and mission. So here's the question to you. I would love for you to just give everyone a taste of kind of where our heads are at. We know that the four focuses before we get to Christmas Day are hope, peace, joy, love. Those are our weekly focuses. So I'm just going to kind of say the word And give me, through that lens of restorative justice and mission, your take on that word. You ready? It's going to be a fun game.
Let's go. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
This is the game that preachers play. Okay. In my family, they're like, okay, preach on this pen. Go. So Joy, the first week is hope in our Advent. What are your thoughts as, you know, grounded in this whole idea of mission and justice?
That's funny. You know, we talk about, like, my first thing that comes to mind is like all the little things on the walls, you know, like faith, hope, and love. But I actually, and I will say a plug for my dear friend, Christy McClelland. If you are curious about anything first century Jewish cultural context, she is incredible. And I have been so thankful to be just in her proximity to learn a lot of this from her. She's amazing. And actually her word, I mean, I don't want to talk about her, but her word for this year is hope. And so she preached on, at the beginning of the year, she preached a sermon that I got to hear with her about hope. And so we learned that, well, to go off on that, but Joshua 2, you know, we talk about Rahab and she, you know, protects the spies. And then they're like, okay, well, this is what you're going to do so that they spare your family. You're going to put this rope out of your window, whatnot. And that rope, that word for rope is tikva. Mm-hmm. And that is also the Hebrew word for hope. And so hope is something tangible that you hold in your hands. It's not this airy fairy concept of something that we're wishing for. It's concrete on the ground, something that that you can hold in your hands. And tikva in the Hebrew is also a feminine word. Mm-hmm. So hope is a chick.
Yeah. I love it. Let's shift to the second week, focus of peace. What comes to your mind when you hear that word peace through this lens?
Well, we were actually talking about you know, when Messiah comes, he'll have healing in his wings and he will usher in the messianic era that is supposed to be peace. And so how could Jesus ever be the Messiah if this is what we're living in? This doesn't feel like peace. But realizing that he is the gift and that relationship with him brings ultimate shalom. I like the feeling of preparation, of being a peace, not just a peacekeeper, but a peacemaker, that activeness in restoring shalom, like deep shalom in people. And even that, even through Sabbath and, you know, the celebration of restoration. What has God done in your life this week? What are those God moments that you can share where he's restored parts of you that were hidden? That's Sabbath. So yeah, just an intentional preparation for his coming.
I love that. And now thinking about justice and mission and the beautiful souls that you serve every day, talk to us about your very name, Joy, that focus on joy.
You know, when I order my coffee, I say joy, like joy to the world, even in July. But I think it's a choice. I think joy is a decision, put on the joy of the Lord. It's an active decision every single day because 90% of the time I don't want to be joyful, but that's not who I am. And that's not what's inside of me. And that's what comes out of me is joy.
Beautiful. And now we come to the last focus, which is love. Tell me about love as we think about justice and mission.
Well, literally the first thing that comes to mind, which is so random, is Isaiah 61. Because when we think about the love of God, I think it's Luke 4 where Jesus gets up in the temple and he shares parts. He only shares the first 1.5 verses of Isaiah 61 when he says it in Luke 4. And that's, to me, it's amazing if you go back and read it. But he stops when he talks about, like he says, you know, I've come to bring in the year of the Lord's favor. Well, the year of the Lord's favor, Ratzon de Adonai, is also the year of Jubilee. So this restoration of land and family. But what he says is that he takes out the land part of it. And he is saying that I am the year of the Lord's favor. I am the ultimate love. And I just think about what that means. The fact that, you know, that we're living in the Ratzon d'Adonai, that we are living in this endless year of the Lord's favor. And the table is open. I mean, going back to that, where he has a seat at the table for me, maybe a pillow where I can lay down at, but that he, you know, even back to preparation, he's prepared a place for me at this table. That just makes me feel so loved.
Joy, when Cheryl was kind of talking about how we're going to just turn Advent on our head this year, like it's going to be so different. It's this unlearning. And so my question for you is, though you have been, serving this beautiful community for so long, is there still things that you have to unlearn as you walk and serve each day?
Every single day. It's just crazy. Even just walking into this building, I get to choose if I look at people in the eye that are sitting on the sidewalk. I can choose fear or I can choose love. I can ignore them. They're used to being ignored. It's no different. But it's my responsibility to live differently and exuding that joy of the Lord. I can do that with my eyes. I don't have to say anything.
Goodness. Listen, I'm so excited. I've got one more question, but I just want to encourage anyone that's listening that it's just so like their curiosity is piqued. They're feeling challenged, in their thinking, their heart's pricked. Please track with us. All the information will be on womenspeakercollective.com on our website. Instagram, womenspeakercollective.com, will have a full 8-week series because we're doing kind of a set the table, getting you thinking about ideas like equity, sweat equity, making space, heart for the marginalized, decentering, radical inclusion and welcome, all those big, big things. And then we'll move into Advent. So just more to come, but keep an eye out for that. As we wind down, you had mentioned the sadness that you feel when people are serving with this beautiful heart of compassion, but focusing on socks and like these tangible like food socks and missing this huge half of the intangibles, the relationship, connection, a place to show authentic, true love. I feel like that is true for us in our faith walk. I feel like we're missing half of this beautiful experience as God's children walking this out. Could you just do a call to action, maybe an invitation for those that have maybe not answered that call to serve in their local communities?
It's like Christianity 101, right? Where you check your box, you do your devotional, you've done all the right things for the day, but you totally miss a relationship with Jesus. Hearing his voice, listening to his promptings. That would be my call, to be still enough in your soul so that you can hear his promptings of the people around you. Because it doesn't have to be, don't go to the, homeless encampment. It could be in your house. Those people that, that you're annoyed with.
Yeah, the people that are struggling with addictions.
100%. In your neighborhood, the ones that make you feel uncomfortable. In whatever, we talk about there's a lot of different marginalized groups. So the ones that make you feel the most uncomfortable, if you're quiet enough, God might prompt you to just show up. He's not asking you to do. He's asking you to be.
So good. Joy, we end every conversation with asking our guests, like, how would you finish this sentence? Together we, and then finish it. and kind of explain to us what that means to you.
This feels like my movie title.
Okay.
Because it just happened. Together we, that's the question?
Yeah.
this is what it is, guys. Together we tikkun olam, which is a Jewish concept of together we repair the world.
People, I cannot. I cannot. Mic drop. Oh, and gave it in Hebrew too. I can't.
I might have that on my body, but you know.
Joy, thank you so much for being a voice of truth, of righteousness, of justice, a voice that calls us not only to action, but to examination of our own hearts. You are recklessly brave, friend, and you also love recklessly, and I love that about you. It's been a joy. Guys, please, please find out everything you need to know about Joy Flores. Look her up, literally JoyFlores. You will see her on Instagram and any websites that they can go to if they want to like donate or support.
My current gospel post is the Nashville Rescue Mission. We out here in these southern streets.
Oh, gosh. Well, we'll put all of details for Joy in our show notes. Joy, thank you so much. It was a pleasure, as always.
You guys are the absolute best. It was my honor to be here with you today.
Hey guys, I get super pumped up when we get into these moments. These are just so meaningful to me, and I know they are to Danielle, where we get to turn the spotlight on world changers, people who are on the ground, in the front lines, doing the hard work, challenging thought, changing narrative, getting us to see things differently. And you know, when we're talking about an audacious Advent, I just happened to look at this descriptor of audacious. Let me tell you, it describes this person to a T. Listen to this. Audacious, extremely bold or daring, recklessly brave, without restriction to prior ideas, highly inventive. Let me tell you, I can say wholeheartedly, I've known this individual for 15 plus years, and from day one, they have been audaciously brave and fearless when it comes to advocating for those on the margins. I cannot wait for you to hear her. Danielle, who do we have?
Yeah, we are excited to welcome Lorraine Lamb. Lorraine is a part of our Women Speakers Collective team, but also she is truly on the front lines. So Lorraine, we'd love to know, you know, who you are, what you're all about, and what you're passionate about these days.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me. So my name is Lorraine. I'm currently based in Toronto, Canada, as opposed to Toronto, California. I've lived here most of my life, spent some time in Singapore as well. I am a daughter of a solo mom and married to a guy named Tim and dog mom to a very extroverted puppy named Miso, who says hi to everybody. So people who don't even know me will know my dog. It's pretty funny. What I'm excited about. Well, I currently work in the community as an outreach worker or a crisis worker, and I've been doing this for almost 15 years, working with people who are unhoused or precariously housed. So these are folks who are also at the intersections of systems around low income and incarceration, mental health, and addictions. So my work is really about supporting people one-on-one, but also about navigating systems and changing systems. And I would say I'm excited about that, and I'm excited about the potential for our world to be a better place.
Lorraine, thank you so much for what you do. I love that the people that you serve, we'll shout out her socials in a bit, but when I say they're literally her family, they are her family. She loves them wholeheartedly. I'd love for you to help us. You know, what do we get wrong when we talk about the unhoused or those who are precariously, unhoused right now? What do we need to know? What are the challenges that would help us to understand better?
I think often we look at social issues, I use those as a quote, and I think we pathologize people and villainize people as opposed to actually starting with asking how we got here in the first place. And I think often when we talk about people who are unhoused or people who are poor, there's often this attachment of stigma around, well, they just need to work harder, or they just need to get a job, or they just need to stop using substances, or they just need to deal with mental health. And, you know, all of those things might be true to a certain degree, but I think we really need to ask how we got here in the first place. What are the policies that make it impossible for people to access housing? Why do we make it impossible for people to access housing? And I think for me, like, one of the questions that I think a lot about is, you know, when Jesus talks about loving your neighbor, he talks about really loving them, which means you actually have to know them. And I think sometimes in the church, we know, like, yeah, we should love our neighbor, but instead what we do is we have pity on our neighbor, or we, you know, think we're saviors to our neighbors. And both of those things are actually not love and not solidarity.
Yeah. Lorraine, I'd love to ask you, like, when was the first time that you realized this for yourself, that you wanted to love your neighbors well? Like, when was this that the start of your passion, that you're like, I want to help those in my community, those who are around me that really need that one-on-one support?
I think for me, so I grew up with a mom who made sure I went to church every Sunday. Even if I like fell asleep at church, I was at church. And I think it was really her faith and just being at church all the time that really drove me to ask this question about, like, well, it's kind of a twofold question. The first is, like, you know, if we're supposed to love our neighbor, and I'm like, I don't even know who my neighbor is. That doesn't make any sense. And this other idea that I think was really planted in me from a young age was this idea of God as our Father. And I think for me, as someone who didn't really grow up with a close relationship with my father, it was a strange comparison for me when we talked to the church about God as Father, because that really, I just didn't understand that. So how could my understanding of God as Father, that just seemed to not make sense if the same God is telling us to love our neighbor? And so I think those were the questions that really drove my beliefs and the things that I sought to understand. And then I think just always aware that, like, you know, growing up with a solo mom and I had friends who had a lot more access than I did, you know, I was always just curious, like, why other people and not me? Why didn't we end up having to rely on a food bank, but other people? And so I think it was really about a curiosity of exploring and hearing other people's stories that I think got me to just want to know people. And then the more you get to know people, the more I think our soul and the spirit in us is drawn to just trying to be present. And I think that is the God image in all of us that is drawn to that.
Lorraine, I think about people who are on the front lines like you, who do extremely hard work, that are exposed to trauma on a regular basis, whose hearts get invested with the people that they serve, and are then shattered and broken in pieces when you see injustice, and then also fueled to anger when, you know, you see them being misused or mishandled or abused. Like, how do you deal with that trauma? What are your mechanisms, coping mechanisms? What do you do to heal and help someone else who's called to the hard things, but is it finds them ingesting, like sort of internalizing them instead?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, if I'm honest, like, I'm constantly trying to figure out what to do, because I think it changes season to season based on just also how I'm doing and what's happening around me. How even like the time of month it is, you know, like, I think all of those things will affect what I need to be well. But I think a lot of my work and the things that I feel, I come back to remembering that justice work is for the long haul. And I think sometimes, especially in the world of social media, things are just like trendy, right? And I think if we approach justice work as a trend, I think that will burn us out. I think for me, I've committed myself to the long-term process of what it means to build change, what it means to be a part of God's work in building kingdom on earth. And so I'm pretty honest in my conversations with the Lord in terms of just laying it out. I think about some of the prophets we read about in scripture, you know, Elijah did a big thing and then he threw a tantrum and ran away. Jonah tried to hide in a whale, all of those things. And I think those are stories of encouragement for me, to give me the space to be honest with God about how I'm feeling about things. Not that there's a resolution, but a reminder that I'm not in this alone and there is a God who is in partnership as well. You know, and there's some other very practical pieces like remembering to eat and sleep, hydrate, and also having people around me who understand, maybe not the exact nuances, but understand that the work is hard and the emotional cost is high, but that we're able to be present for each other in ways that we need. So sometimes I just need to, you know, sit with someone in silence and read a book, and that's great. Other times I need to just be around people and talk about things that don't matter. That's also great. So it's a balance of different things and reminding myself that, again, like, I'm not called to fix things. I'm just called to be a co-laborer, and like, I don't do this alone.
Mm-hmm. Lorraine, you talked about earlier just like having a community and understanding like who these people are and making them your neighbor, making them your actual friends. When you are advocating for these folks in your life and you run into people who don't have that same context, who haven't built proximity with another person, and you're just like, you're fighting for change and that you just hit roadblock after roadblock. How do you deal with that and know like where you're not making movement? How do you understand and like grow with that as, cause that's going to happen, obviously. How do you work with that?
I think a lot about, you know, we read about Rosa Parks taking a seat on the bus, and I think we talk about her specific situation often as just like this one-off thing where, she decided she didn't want to sit in the back of the bus anymore. But I think what we forget is that it's like daily lifetime decisions that she's made that got her to say, I don't want to sit in the bus anymore. And then it's not like she fixed racial justice forever, right? So I think for me, it's reminding that with each discouragement, it doesn't mean that, that's it, everything, you know, is helpless and we're not able to push on. I think what helps me keep going is to remind myself that like change happens in really small increments. Mm-hmm. And also change doesn't happen with just one person. And so, you know, if we're able to move conversations within my circles in a different direction, to me, that's positive and that's change. And we're building collective power. I think sometimes, again, in this world of like social media and like things trending and like influencers and all that stuff, frankly, I think it's actually skewed the perception of justice work where we think one person is going to change everything. Mm-hmm. But if I'm honest, like the things that I've been a part of have been part of collective movements with multiple people involved. And I remind myself that I'm just one person in a larger body with people doing different parts of the work.
Gosh, I love to hear you speak, Lorraine. You know, I'm thinking about the church right now, funny enough, as Rosa Parks, the church as Rosa Parks, because, you know, Rosa didn't, as you said, she didn't solve racial injustice. She helped prompt an important conversation by her willingness to sort of do the uncomfortable thing. And I feel like there's an invitation and has been for some time for the church to get off the back bench, to get out of the back seats, to step forward, to resist, to stand in opposition to speak up. And I wonder if you could help us, because there are people here who are part of church systems that might even be frustrated in their own church systems because of their lack of, you know, voice or action. Kind of like steps one, like just a basic, like one, here's some things to think about of how the church can actually, as you say perfectly, get off the margins and start putting some sweat equity in the game.
Yeah, I think that a really good place to start is honestly just by looking around our current community and think about the people who are missing. Think about the voices that are missing. I think about this a lot in the context of where we get our knowledge. So Sandra Van Opstel is someone who I greatly admire and have learned a lot from. And I heard her speak at a thing one time. I think it was a podcast, and she was like, "Well, why don't?" Actually, I'm pretty sure it was Sandra, or maybe it was Lisa Sharon Harper, one of those two. And they were talking about like, you know, look through the books on your bookshelf and like take a peek to see like if all of your authors are very homogenous and whose voices are missing. And so in the same way, I think as a church, I think we need to look around to kind of see which voices are missing. And I don't just mean like representation, like our board is all white, so we need to throw in like some different colored skin tone. I really mean like what voices are missing from the larger conversation that influences things. And from there, I think it's important that we seek out resources from the communities and listen to what people have been saying for a long time in terms of what needs to happen. I think listening is a really, really important first step. Because I think a lot of times with the best intentions, the church says, oh, we're not doing a very good job around, I don't know, food insecurity. And then right away they want to like start a food bank. But then like, well, what if there's already 5 other food banks in your neighborhood, but they actually just really need help? I think we need to look for ways to partner as opposed to, you know, like trying to start our own thing, because sometimes that's not actually the answer. So yeah, definitely taking a look at missing voices and start by listening.
Mm. Lorraine, you recently wrote a blog post for what we're doing this series, Audacious Advent. And if for those listening, if you haven't jumped in, please do. There's such great content over there from Lorraine and also from Joy. This quote you had at the end of your blog, it said, "We look at Jesus's way of life and his teaching. He repeatedly speaks for what he is for love, for justice, for listening to the oppressed, for jubilee, for healing, for freedom. And he repeatedly models who he is for: the women, the poor, the children, the seekers." So you wrote, "I find myself wondering if the tables I set, both metaphorically and literally, speak a message of what and whom I am for instead of who I'm against." So I'd love to ask you, how do you practically, or how would you encourage those listening to ask themselves, how do you practically add those people to the table as we think about the holiday season and even beyond the holiday season, because it's not just the holidays, it's all year round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a lifetime of work, frankly, because I fear sometimes, and this happened, I think, especially after the murder of George Floyd, we saw a lot of people realizing like, oh no, our spaces are missing, you know, the voices of Black people. And then all of a sudden we tokenized Black people in a lot of our spaces, which for me, like, that's actually perpetuating racism. And so mm-hmm. I think it's, again, like if we recognize that there's people missing at our tables, I think it's making that extra intention to keep an eye out, like, okay, you know, as I'm engaging different people and reading different resources, who can I invite and bring into the space? As opposed to like, you know, scrolling through your neighbor's list and being like, oh, this person sounds like somebody different from me, because then we're tokenizing. So I don't think we're going to, you know, fill our table with different missing voices right away. I think we need to be committed to the process. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about like, you know, when people build their homes and they move into an apartment and like, you know, there's no furniture in there yet. And you're like, yes, I need to get a couch. You're not just going to like, you know, go on the Google and say like, you know, apartment friendly couch and take the first one because it's a couch, right? Like we kind of look around, we do our research, we ask people for recommendations, and then we get the couch that we think is going to make sense for us. And I think in the same way, as we build up our tables, whether metaphorically or physically, if you know, hey, I'm missing the voices of Indigenous theologians, great. Keep that in mind. Ask around, do the Google, all of those things, and commit to the process and be okay with the fact that it's going to take time, because justice will take time.
Goodness gracious. Lorraine Lamb, guys, this lady is something else. I'm going to ask you one last question. Before we wrap, it's a statement I make whenever I get to speak about this topic, and I feel like I'd love to get your thoughts. I'd love your perspective on it. I say the invitation is radically different than welcome, and we make the mistake of making the two similar things, that you can invite people into spaces and they feel absolutely unwelcome. And so there's something deeper than just, like you said, making space at the table. There's something deeper than just presence, face on brochures and things. So, you know, when we talk about radical welcome, there's so many people that want to open up their hearts in new, fresh, intentional ways. Yeah. Can you give us some tips on how we can expand our heart with radical welcome?
Ooh, that is a good question. How do we expand our hearts with radical welcome? I think that I'm going to say that we need to first welcome ourselves in the conversation. And I say this because I think sometimes we need to recognize where our own shortcomings are and where our own strengths are and be gracious to ourselves for making mistakes and be okay to then be like, oh, shoot, I made a mistake. So I think the radical welcome of others starts with our ability to realize that we're radically welcomed into the kingdom of God. So I think about that a lot in the statement of like loving our neighbors as ourselves. I think sometimes we're not very good at the ourselves part. So I think radical welcome, starting with like realizing that we are also welcome in the kingdom of God the way that we are. I think from there, it's challenging. So this is a little, I think it's a lot of self-work for me when I think about this, and it's thinking through like, who are the voices that are speaking that make me uncomfortable? Because that's usually where I know, like, where the friction is happening. I think that's usually speaking to something. So, like, for people who are perhaps, like, you know, into the Enneagram, for instance, there's this thing where they say, like, you know what Enneagram you are based on which type you read and you feel the most uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. So I honestly think that's the other part. Like, I think start with figuring out whose voices make us the most uncomfortable, and can we find ways to engage in conversation with these voices and be willing to listen. I think sometimes, again, in the world that we live in, we're not very good at listening, and we spend a lot of time trying to convince rather than converse. So what does it look like for us to converse with the people that make us a little bit uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. And I want to name that also recognizing that, like, you know, I don't think there's room for certain conversations that make us uncomfortable if it's about like my identity being treated as less than, for instance. But I think there is something to consider about like, okay, what is it about this person's, you know, what they're saying and thought or whatever that's making me uncomfortable? I think start there. And then what does it look like to challenge ourselves to do something that is outside of our comfort zones? You know, maybe a lot of us are really comfortable with packing shoeboxes for Christmas, right? I think it's asking, why are we comfortable doing that? And what would be something more uncomfortable? What does it look like to actually engage with a family down the street who looks different from me? And instead of packing a shoebox to send to Lord knows where, what if we packed a box that was suitable for our neighbor down the street? Because we probably know their needs better, or we can just ask them directly. So I really think radical welcome starts with discomfort, which is weird because it doesn't sound like welcome, but yet I think that's what the radical piece is about. Mm-hmm.
Lorraine, in this space that you are working with justice, there are moments where we can really truly celebrate. So I'd love for you to think back with, you know, the last 5 or 10 years, and maybe it's something really small that you really hold on to and you celebrate often to remind yourself, like, God is working, change is happening.
I have this distinct memory at my wedding. So at my wedding, it was really important to me that people in the street community that I had known for a long time were there. So we were really intentional about planning where we would have our ceremony. And we planned to just like, okay, it's going to be downtown. Here's the invitation. We put it on the community board and like made it really clear that anybody was welcome, which, you know, meant that it could be complete chaos. We had no idea, but we're like, this is going to be great. Kingdom chaos is what a colleague of mine used to say. And I think about how one of my friends, his name is McLeod, he showed up that day, you know, just woke up on the street, came with his like sleeping bag thrown over his backpack, and his like hoodie, just like everything that he like has been living in. And he showed up at the wedding. He was so excited. He's like front row in all the photos, like thumbs upping. And he still talks about this 5 years later as having so much fun. And I think for me, that moment, plus my friend who walked me down the aisle is a guy who is one of my closest street friends. And I saw my mom go up to him and my mother initiated a hug. And like, listen, y'all, you need to understand that like Asian mothers, we do not physical touch. Just don't do that. Maybe we'll high five, but hugs are not the norm. But she initiated a hug with this gentleman who is radically different from who she is. And I think those are two things that for me are so small, but so huge, because it says to me that a kingdom reality is possible, that we can learn to love each other and see each other where we're at and find ways to coexist. I think we have to figure out how, though, because I'm not sure that the path we're going sometimes is leading us to that. but I deeply believe that better is possible. And I think that's what I'm really committed to. Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
Lorraine, I just want to thank you so much. You are just, I'm sitting here smiling from ear to ear because every time you speak, it's just amazing. So glad, so thankful for your voice and the way you sacrifice and live and give and serve and show up for those who are on the margins. And I'm so thankful that you challenge us. And just, you're like the John the Baptist, I believe, just that one crying in the wilderness, just like, you know, challenging, shaking us up. I love it. I live for it. Let's end here with this, this thought. You know, when you think about women, this being obviously a women's leadership podcast, what's your hope in the future for women? When you think about things you'd love to see at work?
I would love women to know and deeply believe that we are worthy of liberation, and that not only are we worthy, but that all of our betterness and liberation and freedom is deeply wrapped up in each other's. So, you know, when I do my advocacy work for street women, I'm not just like, oh, it's just for street women, but it's deeply connected to the liberation for Black women and Asian women and Christian women and Muslim women. And I think I want us to see that interconnectedness as the vision of what Jesus had when he says, like, the kingdom of God is here. And I hope that that's an invitation for us to build towards it.
Mm. Lorraine, thank you so much for sharing with us. I think you really emphasize what radical Christ-centered love, even though that is hard, it can also be restorative and beautiful. So thank you for sharing with us today. If you wanted to connect with Lorraine, all of her information will be in today's show notes, and plus check out her blog on our Audacious Advent. Thank you so much for joining us, Lorraine.